Well, so maybe we'll talk about the force distributions first and then.
We're good?
So I guess, let me publish it. So the one piece of what I might say about force distributions would relate to something I didn't show last time, which is, you know, five minutes worth of that thing.
Great.
So how about if I do that and then come back in this context, and also there was a companion paper to this work that appeared in Nature by the Chicago group. And it might be worth looking at what they have, because on the surface of
they seem
contradictory.
Yeah, but okay, great.
So try to contrast them, because they don't look at all alike.
I think it'd be worth to go over the new information, because we can, all those of us who are really focused on force distribution, can discuss those later.
Okay. So let's just move down.
That's a fast talk.
Okay, so this is actually experiments that were done by Karen Daniels. And the context here was a 3D shear experiment. So what you're looking at here is, this is a vertical cut through something with axial symmetry. So it's an angular region where the real spheres, which are fairly close to Monica's purpose, and they're being sheared by a rough surface up here, which is, so it has roughness which is not periodic, so random surface bumps, and then it's being taken from underneath. And at the same time, then we measure, so the shaker actually provides some additional static loading, and we measure the pressure over some region which is roughly a square centimeter at the bottom of something which is 3 or 4 centimeters across.
With the rough surfaces is not the way you described it before. I'm going to say the inner or the outer cylinder, correct?
In the 3D experiments? Yeah, so this is particles stuck down randomly on this surface.
On that surface.
Okay. That's
the surface that's...
That's the surface that's sheared.
And the sidewalls?
The sidewalls are smooth, and then you can look through them. And that, in fact, so you're looking through the unusual cut, trying to look through some. You can look through the whole sidewall, but of course we can't even see some window.
So in that picture of understanding the orientation, you actually see the bottom one is like a grain boundary between the two crystal orientations?
No, this system is, and you may have local regions of order, but overall it's a disordered system.
You have to explain that picture to us, the pictures on the...
These are two different states of, these are characteristic of two different states that we see. One of which is order, okay, 3D. So if you pull this system apart and look inside, it's crystallized. Yeah.
What am I seeing with these sort of hard triangles? The question is whether you see it from the side. You see that from the right?
From the side. Looking into the side here, the stripes are because we build up the wall of the stack ring on plexiglass thing. So ignore that these stripes are just an artifact.
It's the inner
face. Yeah, so they're not, don't look at the stripes, look at whatever the particles are. Yeah.
They're spherical particles?
And the spherical particles, right. Okay. At least they start out that way. Okay, so you've got two different states here, and I'll tell you how you get them, but let me show you what they look like. Okay. So now it's being vibrated. Okay, so it's being vibrated here. These are relevant high speed videos. Okay. You can see the particles are being sheared from the top.
So the only lateral force is at the top. Is that
no
right?
Lateral force.
It's to the left?
To the left, actually. And so the whole thing, of course, is being dragged along.
I'm a little worried about this. You've sliced off, it looks like you've sort of tried to make a combination of three different pictures that you've sort of sliced off in front of us.
Yeah, I mean, this is a freshman physics object. You're looking through, you know, stacks of material with the boundary, which is, it sounds a little bit of scattering or lack of boundary. So
So do you extract strain or displacement versus vertical position?
I don't know how that's, I mean, I have a very strong shear diagonal. I probably don't have that in the slot, so I can share with you. Okay, and now this guy is a disordered state. And again, it's being vibrated, and this system has to have got out of a fair amount. And if you then look at some measure of, you know, if you look at GWAR or something like that, the system is disordered.
It doesn't seem to be moving quite as rapidly along the base as the previous one.
Well, I mean, you know, these, you have to remember this, you know, video, right? They'd be different. So don't, or they just be as slow as you can see.
I mean, it's clearly not perfectly ordered, but GWAR, I mean, GWAR could miss polycrystalline information. It does look like there's
So you can
strong local order.
You can get some local order.
Which would vary a lot as a function of height.
It does vary. It doesn't vary as much as you want. But it does vary some. So I think that's good. Not sure. All right. So hopefully maybe I'll have the structural information somewhere. At any rate, you can simply look at the density of the system, the packing function. The function of shear rate, and once you find is the system solidifies into a crystal at low shearing, and then as you get shear melts, then you go to high shearing. And that's a hysteretic transition, so that once you have disordered, then it should come back down.
What happens to the torque when it shear melts?
No idea. Sorry.
What was that question?
Well, it turns out that if you look at colloidal crystals, when they undergo the transition from a shearing solid phase to a fluid phase, the stress actually rises.
As far as
it's harder to shear the fluid and solid.
Interesting.
So shear,
it's counterintuitive.
Shear strengthening?
You get shear strengthening associated with nothing.
Well, in some sense, this system is strengthening. But the strength is not clear. So what's happening, okay, if you look at the packing fraction, it's steadily as things grow, as you shear it faster and faster. Okay, so it's actually pushing against the load. Okay, so it does get stronger in that sense.
Well, so that's a normal stress, which is linear in shear rate, which is also what we've seen in the simulations of the...
No, it's longer.
Oh, sorry, forget it.
So
this is the same logarithmic strengthening that you see in the 2D short spread.
What's the right hand axis?
The right hand axis is the high hand.
So it's getting denser, is it?
No,
it's getting less dense.
It's getting less dense.
Oh, I see, because
it's okay. Right. So basically,
But that's the packing fraction is changing logarithmically.
Right, so it's dilating.
The normal stress is constant. And so the experiments on the colloids are done at constant packing fraction, measuring the change in normal load. It's hard to compare the two.
Right.
Because you need to know how the normal load depends upon packing fraction.
I have one following question on the way you described this. We see red is increasing.
Red is crystallized.
No, red solid crystallized. But red in general is increasing, blue is decreasing, or black is decreasing. And so we're seeing, did you describe this as a hysteretic
type
effect? Because then it does suddenly jump back to an order.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's hysteretic. So you jump back to the lower shear rate.
And one common assemblage you can use.
I'm sorry.
You can use one assemblage of particles and just progressively increase the rate and then decrease the rate.
And this is all the fixed number of particles. Absolutely.
So I've just been down at Irvine, and I was visiting Mike Dennett, and he was showing me some of his reality experiments. And I think he said that he was seeing some important effect of the walls on whether he saw like a band deformation or like a homogeneous shear across them. I was wondering, How do you control for the effect of the containing walls?
Okay, so his, when you say his containing walls, that means his surface which is shearing or surface with maybe is.
So it's a different, right? Like the film, I think, was maybe could be contained between two plates, and then shear could be applied, or you take off the plate,
right.
And just, and so in the case where there was a plate right on top, you saw very localized shearing near the sliding surface.
Right.
In the case where you removed the top plate, you saw like a uniform distribution of shear.
That's a drag effect.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, you have drag effects in a cell of this.
You have some. Right? I mean, it's smooth. The idea is you make those boundaries as smooth as you can, so that effect is minimal. And you can't get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So there's no equivalent to taking off the top. But I think that is, you know, the friction with the walls is relatively new.
Gamma is the vibration rate. That's what's plotted on the lower axis.
It's a shear vibration. It's a shear. So it's
why is it in hertz?
How fast you
vibrate? Okay, okay.
It's a period of rotation or hertz.
Gamma
is the acceleration.
What?
The gamma is the shape of the
shape. The gamma is health. Is the
gamma. Oh, gamma is
your peak acceleration is 2g.
Okay, so that's all constant, but the shear rate, which is given by omega.
Okay.
And the frequency?
So, frequency is 64.
So, when you, if this is showing the packing fraction versus shear, have you looked at the width of the shearing region as a function of shear rate?
It's good. I don't have that right here. I have to leave that out, but I can show that to you anyway. So, I mean, so
that does tend to thicken the shearing layer.
Yeah, that's right. So here is a measure of, so these are spatial autocorrelations. And when you're in the crystalline regime, what you tend to get is something like these guys. And then when you move into the fluid-like phase, right, you get in-plane order, which is sort of like the stuff that Golub and Sana have seen, right? I don't know if you guys are you guys familiar with that? Okay, so a set of experiments which were done by Jerry Golub and Jason Tsai. Mm-hmm. And in those experiments, they have a somewhat similar experiment to this, except there's no vibration, and it was fluid filled, so they could visualize what was going on. And so then what they found is if they waited a long, long time, then there was invariably a transition to an in-plane ordered state. So they had layers, hexagonal layers, which were sloughing across other hexagonal layers. Which I think is something people see in comments as well.
Yeah, we certainly saw in the simulations you have similar sort of obstruction in the plane scattering functions.
So liquid crystal.
Yeah.
Right. Except that I mean it still has a finite range, so it's not like so in all of psi experiments, really there was correlation essentially on the scale of the experiment.
Sure. But what does the flow look like if you look down from the top? I mean, is it like a plug and it's flowing fast in between two walls, or?
In the crystalline phase, you
in either.
Okay. So we can't really look, by the way, down from the top or into the center, except by pulling the system apart, we might stop. So we know that when we pull it apart, have pulled it apart, okay, it appears crystalline all the way through. So therefore it tends to flow more or less as a plug. And if you look at the movie in crystalline phase, you can see that plug slipping across the bottom. And then there was a very, very narrow one particle light shear zone at the top. But other than that, you tend to have unblocked movement of the whole thing. On the other hand, you know, once you start talking about a disordered phase, then well it's much harder to say for us exactly what's going on with the change. But you can see that if you do get these linear strands. So if you look here, and you see regions which are crystalline orders, there's a little piece of crystalline order, and you see other places where it looks like you have lines which are slipping across. So you have competition between those two sorts of things. All right, so now, so this was sort of what I was leading up to. It was going to so if you look at now the force distributions as seen at the bottom of surface distributions, so, and now you look as a function of where you are in the space diagram, if you're in the crystalline phase, then you see things like this, okay? And keep in mind this is on a log limit scale. So what these are is basically a PDF of what you would see if you had an oscillating wave sitting on a plate, right? So a PDF of a sine function is a Batman function, if you say about that. Okay? True? And then, and now, so the interesting thing is, if you move into the fluidized space, right, then you get these PDFs which actually look a lot like what we saw earlier when we just applied a load on the system and sheared it. But when you go close to the transition, then the tail stretches out way, way far.
How do you measure the force in this case?
It's a capacitive pressure gauge. Okay, so it has, so it's a centimeter sized disk, yeah, and the particles are 2 or 3 millimeters. So you've got 10 particles at a time.
And so you're averaging over
that range.
Would you remind me what Crichton's is?
Yeah, it's a transfer. Okay, it's a scale fourth moment. So it's a departure from the Gaussian. Okay, and so what's happening is you're skewing things way out of this, and that gets appears, for instance, most clearly in the Cortosis, which has this cusp-like structure that you're coming down.
The dashed line there is just beyond the eye.
That is a guy beyond the eye. That
we're seeing.
Well, there's a point of it. I mean, so. Getting defensive. Okay. So there's an amusing singularity here. And by the way, it's interesting.
Okay. Now, this side of the room needs to understand.
Okay. All right.
No,
I was just interrupting him on your behalf.
I'm sorry.
Did somebody interrupt her own mic?
I'm just confused by the omegas there. So it's not monotonic, is it? The different currents?
Yeah, because well, there may be not a monotonic. The point is that this curve is sitting right near the transition point. So let's see. Not sure what
that is. It is
But the point is that as you go into the transition region, you're right, stretching out. So it's not a long time.
And that's the point of it.
Yeah, the green is there.
And that the new
right. Okay.
And accompanied with these stretching out of the forces.
So do you know whether you're supposed to be in here or in here? Small seminar.
There is a small seminar. There is a seminar in this small seminar.
All right, I'm probably in the wrong place. So we hope.
Well, we were if you look at the volume fluctuations in the system, you see something comparable. So this is the Kurtosis area, and then if you look at the volume fluctuations, they have the same kind of cusp. Okay, the volume fluctuations are the equivalent of a specific heat in an Edwards formalism. So this is said we have a specific heat anomaly at this transition point.
So that's in full equilibrium, that's not a hysteresis in that plot?
It's steady state, you mean? I see.
These
are all steady states.
But if you have a hysteretic transition, then your transition would be at different points going up.
This is the data coming down. Yeah.
So the data coming up would look slightly different?
They would be shifting.
Can you somehow independently check the compressibility, or?
Yes and no. Okay, so the one trick is you measure the pressure at the bottom. Okay. Yes, in principle, you measure the compressibility. The amusing thing is what you measure at the bottom doesn't account for the full load on the system. So there is some stress transfer to the walls, which you can measure, and it actually is a function of where you are in the phase diagram.
Can you tell us that if you could somehow change some other parameter, perhaps the density
Right, but you actually be exactly at the critical point.
Well, it's not a critical,
it's not critical.
It's not a first order.
It's both first order and critical, like, it's bizarre. It's like, I'm just like jamming, it has first order and critical line properties, you know?
This defines a discrete phase transition, is that how we're going to this?
Yeah, it does, well, it, yeah, I mean.
That's what I'm trying to quote.
Jim was asking this question yesterday.
Yeah, and the question is what kind of a, in what sense is a phase transition? Now I'm really confused.
Could it exist at both states at that point, is that the end of the question?
Well, that's what, he seems to be, he's histories.
His histories.
So that makes him think that it's got some first order pair.
That's right.
On the other hand, he's also seeing a divergence of some sort of.
I don't think it's really divergence. Well, it's singular but not divergent. You can be singular but not divergent.
Okay, but a mean field model which doesn't get the correct.
Right.
But, you know, it's singularity.
That's still singular.
It's not divergent, but it's.
Just continue.
Something like this.
Right.
And then most of those models, you can, first place you can do the your calculation better, especially if you know where the actual critical point is, like a zero magnetic field or something like that. But you can also for other systems dial some parameter that actually makes it a critical. The question is something like that happening?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think the answer is you could argue that that's at least partly true. I mean if you dial the density just wrong, yeah, and you're not in gravitational field, then you could clearly go to something that looks more like a critical change.
Mm-hmm. So for instance, if it's a sort of weakly first order transition, that's somehow just not too far from curve.
No, I mean, to what extent would this curve be singular if it didn't see there was a jump? Because I know it's singular. I think it seems singular because the one phase becomes unstable, mm-hmm, and you jump into the other one.
Right.
But if you didn't see the curve, if you didn't see the discontinuity, uh-huh, at this point two,
right,
you would have no means of saying that if you just see the one branch of the curve,
right,
things would be singular, mm-hmm, at that point.
So you would say that it just would continue since for some reason it's going up.
Or it's going up. I don't really think you can argue. It might be nice to check things like, you know, size behavior, because, mm-hmm, that's when you can get a guess whether you really have something that becomes singular.
Mm-hmm.
But just looking at that data,
uh-huh,
I wouldn't be convinced that that curve is singular at all.
Well, I mean, it's supposed that ideally there's just, you know, those fluctuations are zero up to point two, and then which is finally discontinuity.
Well, but you only see the discontinuity because the one phase becomes.
And if this is the specific heat, then that's not a problem for a first order transition.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think it you could argue it's a first order transition with, you know, some fluctuations happening near the transition. And,
right.
Sure. And if you just look at like nucleation droplet theory, if you, as you go towards the point where you actually become unstable in the nucleated critical droplet, you'd think that before that you'd see more fluctuations, like more bubbles would try to grow.
You know, all kind of in the those funny old droplet bubbles of the critical phenomena. Before we knew about the normalization.
But if you're looking at a first order transition and looking at.
That's what you see. You see
more.
And you just do a mean field approximation. You get a function. The specific heat doesn't specifically have a
finite jump.
And it's just a finite jump.
Yeah.
Comes up to a point and falls off.
Yeah.
And it's smooth behavior up to the jump and smooth behavior past.
Yeah, right, but the question is it smooth with an increase?
But not a mean field.
Well, you can have a finite increase in the field.
It may or not be, and I think you're looking at changing particle size. So your argument would be that if you increase the scale of your system or decrease the size of your particles, that this would move in. occur in a smaller range or something like that? Is that the thrust of your argument?
Or I think you should see maybe a bigger range of increase if you had more particles.
Well, no, smaller range.
Well, if
it's really, what are sort of like transition,
first
dominated by a finite size effect, because it has to go away when your system
right, but I would say if it's second order, then if it was critical, then it would, you'd see a bigger range.
Right. So that is a good idea of trying to distinguish between critical life and super critical. Okay.
Well, if I try to understand geometrically the causes of the features that we're seeing here, right. The distributions that you show, should you go back one slide just for a second? Mm-hmm. The Batman curve, and this is just a check if I'm correct, but the Batman curve suggests to me that you have two peaks because of the distinct orientations of the force vectors, because you have such a highly crystallized system.
No, I don't think so.
It's because he has a sine wave force, and because you're the maximum and minimum force of that sine wave, you spend a lot of time, that you're more likely to be with the big force or the small force. Just take a sine wave and ask how often the sine wave has a given height. And there'll be many more times when it's either the maximum or the minimum than near the center.
So the change is slow.
Is this the sine wave comes about from the vibration?
Yeah, no, it's from the vibration.
From the vibration.
And it's measuring it on the vibrating plate.
And then this is averaging over all of those values.
That's right.
Okay, I misunderstood that.
Yeah.
But maybe this question still, or this statement is still correct, that where you have the transitional condition,
right.
It's the effort of trying to break out of that order that results in high forces in local regions, but a relatively small number. And once it breaks out of that, then you've gone through that dilation phase, basically.
For instance, that's probably, that sounds like the same. Okay.
And so the larger the system size, then those would be averaged over more particles. And probably the tail would contract a little bit.
Well, and the question is how, in some sense you could think of it as a correlation. What you tend to see, for instance, in this fluidized region is correlated chunks, which come together. And the size of that chunk, I think, probably grows as you approach the transition point level. And that, so then when you look at the at these volumes, so if you look here, right, which is what is tending to happen, you get these correlated chunks, which push the system apart. And they're growing as you get closer and closer to this transition point.
There's probably distinct orientations for those, too.
Oh, absolutely, of course.
The shear
yeah. But I mean, there's more than one orientation that, you know, will probably form.
So Bob, this is still on the limit where the fluidization is only near the top wall, right? And yet you're measuring the bottom wall. And so the question is, are you just seeing fluctuations in this structure being transmitted through a fairly elastic path, or are you seeing rearrangements all the way to the bottom?
So you see rearrangements all the way to the bottom. And so it's not ordered. It's not like you have a disordered region sitting on top of an ordered region. The joint disorder is through.
The disorder is all the way down, but the shear is still localized.
But the shear, the actual displacement is localized close to the bottom.
That's interesting. If it were a phase transition, especially the first order phase transition, and I think we're probably just as likely to see it. The disordered regions being separated from the jammed region.
Yeah, you could have coexistence.
In some sense, you have local coexistence. Right? So you have little crystallites that float around the system. Both of these planar crystalline states and other 3D crystal states, or these planar crystal states.
You could have the whole bottom crystal.
You could. I mean, that's, of course, you know, depending on gravitational field, you don't think that would happen. That's not what we see.
You're sure it's not what you see? Because after all, even if it's really, you know, pretty jammed and pretty solid, I would expect to see the occasional rearrangements because I've got, you know, it's supporting some sort of stress.
So,
I see.
But this might be far from the transition. You might think right near the transition that...
See, essentially no rearrangements going on.
Well, it's slow. Just slow.
It's slow. There's one at the end. Just,
That is crystalline. This is, and these sort of look like crystalline.
It will completely transform from this back to that water.
That's impressive.
Right.
I think the vibrations are critical to that.
That's right. It's very easy to produce the orbs.
Vibrations are doing something like adding a temperature.
They are, and they actually give the system the opportunity to explore a piece of face space that would never find them.
It keeps cracking. That's quite interesting too.
Dislocation.
Yes.
Of course, there has to be dislocation to this geometry.
It's not a crack that stays open, or that. I don't see any rearrangements along that.
It opens up and closes right and peels right back up. And these are
there's a lot of rigidity.
Well, it is, and of course, also this double peak state. So phase boundary. Okay, so there is a phase boundary apparently between the crystalline and the disordered state. And the phase boundary, so this is again, this is a measure, dimensionless measure of the acceleration, and then this is a measure of the shear rate. And the transition point occurs apparently when the energy input per particle from shaking equals the energy input per particle from shear. That seems to be the transition dimension.
So that line comes from?
This line just says, in some gross measure, put the energy input per particle from, A omega squared, A squared omega squared equals 1/2 omega squared.
Do you really measure these values, or do you have a calculation where you estimate these values when the omega is less or greater than the gamma?
These are all measured points.
But there's pre-omegas and mini-gammas. Do you actually measure them, or do you...
The pre-factor in this group?
Yes. And so the value for your omega and the value for your gamma, do you measure that directly, or do you...
That line is drawn as the point at which one omega square is equal to 1/2 omega. Something of that sort.
So you know the amplitude.
These are all quantities that we know.
But then we don't really know how much of the energy the system gives back to the external device. And just having a frequency in displacement doesn't really give you an energy input.
No, not specifically, right? So there's some, so if you like, put in scale factor 1 and scale factor 2, and then your observation is that those, the ratio of those factors is 1.
The energy induced with shear is not necessarily E omega squared either. That's assuming a viscous type response, which is not necessarily the case. You don't know the shear stress, right?
This is just saying, put that line on that stick and ask how well does it describe. And the answer is it seems to describe it well. So now you can ask, why does it describe it well? Okay, but don't tell me,
Well, but I think to call it E omega is misleading.
Potentially misleading.
I'm really confused.
Well, it is potentially misleading. But I mean that's where the line goes, whether you
I understand.
So this line
we have no problem with.
Right.
Find it. I'm just saying that if you go ahead and you look at what E omega is,
right?
It's not necessarily that. The actual, how would you define, if you really wanted to find the energy in the shear, how would you define it? You take it.
Sure.
You have to have force times displacement rate times the time.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so, the force is not necessarily proportional to the displacement rate.
Sure. And you can imagine creating other parameters,
right,
which characterize the energy.
And I guess I'm particularly sensitive to this particular issue because if you look at a paper by Shira Mamaswamy and Ren, they had argued that the transition temperature or colloidal shear melting had to go as the square root of the shear rate, okay? Based on an argument that the energy associated with the shear went quadratically in the shear rate, and that the free energies of the focus and phase should be equal.
Theory would do something like that.
Experimentally, it goes linearly because there's a yield stress. And that's something that came out of our simulations as well. So the energy, in fact, had a constant shift plus a linear term as opposed to being quadratic. And completely, the experimentalist actually, Paul Chaikin, took all this data and kept looking linear, but he knew it had to be quadratic. So he threw the data out and never published it. One of the simulations was linear. I understood why.
Is that not published?
No, I couldn't find it. The student had moved on and become Dan Liang. He moved on to Liang and become a professor, and the computer disk had been on and it's all gone. So
the another question. Presumably, if you increase gamma way out, it's going to null again.
That's, well, not necessarily because it's in fixed. If it's in positive fixed, we have to be able to go out of experiment.
You might have to do some different.
In some sense, this also gets, in the context of what Mark was saying, I have to know the applicability. Because that determines the things like the yield stress or the ability of the system to expand and so forth. So it's not a yes, in principle, yes, to your question. In practice, there's some other things you have to do.
And you don't know what. The torque is a no way of measuring.
It's not easy to measure the torque in this system. I mean, it's not impossible for us, but we have to put torque in it. So, for you, Mark, I'm
okay. Great. Well, if you're comparing the energies, what you wrote on the board there, I don't see gamma.
Oh, yeah. So you have to put in. Can you see it from here? Let me do it on this board.
I think it's 1/2.
Prasad on the chart.
It's easier to see. He's really got 1/2 velocity squared equals 1/2 velocity squared.
That's
where in one
like.
Case, the velocity is the amplitude times the frequency, and the other, the particle diameter times the shear rate.
So
which one's the amplitude times the frequency?
So gamma is. Gamma is.
Hey, Bob.
We turned on the letter.
Oh, really? So gamma is A omega squared. But with the G. And so, therefore, if you like, gamma is.
Okay.
So you have to. Intrinsically, you don't have plots of data on what A is.
Because we often use. But I've never seen omega used for shear. So I was thinking you were using it for some, representing some angular velocity.
Well, we have two omegas in this problem.
Right.
It's not something to each one. So
thanks.
These are experiments this kind of thing, like where you do compressional experiments or pure shear, or you can do your next. And then what we see is the problem that when you shear the system, what you tend to do is you don't change the inertial forces, which are small anyway. So they're 10% of the normal forces that you need. But when you shear, you populate the time for part of the distribution function, which is, doesn't seem unreasonable because what you're doing is you're giving some small set of particles or a small set of contacts a large force to carry the compression alert. When you compress the system, then in fact, you're carrying, in some sense, you get something which is more gas, in sense, which you don't need these large load carrying particles, and that pushes in more part of the distribution.
And if you don't have any plastic rearrangement, just take an elastic material with some disorder,
right,
and you don't get the exponential tail. It's
under compression.
Yeah.
I'll have it under shear.
Well, it's only under shear. It doesn't matter. You just take some sample and you close the strain, unless you're actually forcing it to rearrange.
Right.
You don't see an exponential tail.
And what do you consider rearranging? So this is actually what you're doing, you're opening your contacts in one direction.
No, in the compressor, in the compression case, because you're just sort of pushing stuff in and there's no reason why there's massive rearrangement.
Well, there are no massive rearrangements.
Well,
and it can be.
There may be almost no rearrangements in the case of compression.
Yes. Right. Certainly there are probably no, this is probably the first.
And I'm just saying, if I take a static configuration and I force all the bonds to be elastic or do anything that keeps things from breaking and rearranging the bonding, then I will never pick up an exponential tail.
Okay, I will do that.
And so in the compressive case, you're not forcing that rearrangement, so you can't really expect anything interesting to happen. But in the shear case,
Stuff
sort of rearranges at the margin.
But now we're asked whether it matters whether you have attractive forces in the problem as well.
I'm going to interject a little bit here because what I see here is two points on a broad continuum that represents the stress state of the assemblage during shear or deformation.
Absolutely.
And it's not like there's one compressive state or one shear state, as might be implied by this diagram, but that it depends on the magnitude of the stresses, the principal stresses, which is the relative magnitude of the principal stresses that are acting on the system. So in the case of shear, because you have allowed the system to dilate, you also have reduced the compression in the direction perpendicular to the principal force orientation. In compression, you have an isotropic stress state.
You don't allow dilation.
Not pure shear. So it's pure shear.
Okay.
It started from the state of originally zero pressure.
Wait, what's the configuration of this? Pure shear means that you're coaxial strain and stress?
Yes, it's squeezing in one pair of directions and then expanding equally.
Okay, well, that is able to dilate and it is maintaining. No, not dilation, I'm sorry, but you're introducing a tensile state. So there's compression in one direction while tension in the other.
There's no tension now.
You have to have a little bit of tension in order to allow...
Well, there's no, you can't have
less compression the other way.
Okay.
It's pure shear.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
So you expect these tails to stay, even for instance, if in the 4% strain guy, you crank up the pressure until Z equals 3.7?
So you want to do uniaxial compression?
Starting from the shear guy, then you compress until you get to the same, either same pressure or same Z in the other guy.
So there's the uniaxial compression. I mean, it's not clear. I think this is not as good data, so we haven't done as much as that.
Here you mean there are no horizontal, no lateral forces.
Well, I think there's a set. I wouldn't want to bet the wrench on this run, but this thing actually is stretching out slightly slower than exponential. This is clearly much faster than exponential, and it can go into something like the state where that Craig was saying, where you now have something, I think, approximating uniaxial compression. You just squeeze in one direction and don't let it dilate in the other direction. then you can not get it done.
Yeah, that shouldn't be called compression, because you're allowing the stresses to increase in the lateral dimension. So I mean, well, maybe this is different in the
literature. You would call any axial compression if you were stress-free and perpendicular.
Right.
Okay.
So we call it uniaxial consolidation because you can deform it without any lateral deformation.
Right, okay.
Okay. But in this case, then, you do have increasing stresses in the lateral direction.
So you do have stresses growing in the minor principal stress.
And what are the different quantities plotted here?
So these are different definitions, not very different. So all of order ones.
Oh, it's the magnitude of the deformation? Shortening, for example?
Yeah. Okay. So the fraction will change.
And then scaled with the mean force, it shows.
And then scaled by the mean force.
I was very interested in the plots that you showed yesterday where you were doing the correlation function as a function
of
orientation, because I think that would address the issue in the previous plot where you have compression state versus a shear state.
That's
if you plot that up as a function of principal stress direction and the principal stress ratios, you would probably see a much better correlation among the different regimes that you could do these tests.
So what you're saying is if you divide it by the principal stresses,
then you
would see the same behavior in all directions. It doesn't quite work.
You've done that?
Yeah. Okay, so you still, alternatively, right, I would say that the correlation function would look the same in some sense. I mean, it doesn't quite work out.
Okay, I believe that,
yeah. I can dig out data with my address then.
So in terms of Craig's question, at least what I see is if I take a state and that's gone to this magic exponential tail thing, and now I squeeze on it in some uniform way.
What's exponential?
What? The tail in the distribution is exponential.
Of some that distribution of
forces.
With magnitude forces.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have a sheared state, and once you have the sheared state, the special distribution, then you progress it back to the other.
Yeah, well, whatever state, you know, like the crazes are another example, right? If you take a state and you add stress to it, and there's no rearrangements going on, then we don't see that, you know, that extra stress is not necessarily going to go into that same exponential tail distribution. It's sort of a more orderly thing. And so it's really crucial that you be somehow rearranging things.
I see that maybe in your picture, but I mean, so let me run back.
In this uniaxial compression, were the strains big enough to see rearrangements?
There's very tiny bits of rearrangement.
In the uniaxial compression.
Oh, in uniaxial compression.
In the pure compression, there's no particular reason
why things would change.
But in uniaxial, I don't think there is.
So let me pull out the case of this curve here. So I squeezed it and dilated it. And it seems to me the key thing here is not that you're breaking, and not that you're rearranging, but that you have different kinds of contacts. And you have these strong contacts here, which show up in the tail, right? And then, if you like, you have weak contacts in the other direction, which tend to bolster the low pulse.
I agree with that completely, because you can see this type of arrangement develop with very, very small strains.
Exactly. So you can't. I can give you one of these
pictures. What do you call small?
No rearrangements, just that you might see a very slight rotation of the particles. So they're not moving past each other.
Right.
They're just simply now rotating in order to maintain.
That's basically the same. You're not doing major rearrangements.
You're not seeing any.
You could essentially be an elastic deformation.
Too strong, but there's very small deformation, irreversible deformation going on in the system. You can push it further. So if you push this.
So what percentage strength?
Well, it could be reversible. I mean, it doesn't have to be irreversible. It could be.
You guys have friction, which is the one thing that could make it different. But
that's a bit of a compound. But you can show that's the case.
But certainly, if you take certainly this structure is also correlated to the observation. But I just, in the simulations, I haven't seen this kind of structure develop without some rearrangements of particles.
So you do see such a structure develop under saturation?
You can see such structures develop.
But see, I would argue one big difference is that in some sense, maybe it's not a big difference, but I mean, your system stays connected. I mean, when you pull the system apart, your system is still connected. You can have tension in your system. I can't have tension. So I can imagine pushing this, and really, the particles open up, and that's just as irreversible, I think. You totally destroy a content, but you can restore it by going backwards. So it's reversible, and I don't see an analog in your system.
It was the cracks that we saw forming during the simulations here. You see things fracking open and then shutting again without changing the formation.
And this is how it happens out in the heels.
Yeah, it turns out the piece of parts don't do as interesting things as the you don't get exponentials on both sides.
Your forces aren't symmetric that way either. It's not clear to me whether it's just the friction versus whether you have an attractive part of your force.
Well, what I would say is you have, in addition to having plastic rearrangements, which I think can lead to this, you have the opportunity for the local friction forces to go past some threshold, right?
They can slip, right?
And so that type of rearrangement also allows the force
distribution. There's very, very few observable slips. For a few percent deformation. If you say, I'm going to do 10% deformation, start to see slips.
Okay, so typically for us, every particle has had plastic rearrangements by 5%.
Okay, so I mean, I think what's probably happening here is there will not have, there's a friction that stabilizes this plastic. We don't see plastic in this.
We do shear experiments which generally go up to say 200% strain or more. Then of course there's this initial stage where the particles are deforming elastically without undergoing significant reorganization, and that's while the strength is increasing. And then we reach a peak strength, and from that point on we essentially shear the entire assemblage.
Right. And so question is, if you're looking, going up, first of all, what strain does that peak correspond to? You get these chains?
It's usually on the order of peak. I would say between 5 and 10%.
That's what you see here. And this is, less than 5%, you would see the structure.
True. Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely. Anyway, you know, 1%, 0.5%.
In our case, we don't have a crystallized structure, and so consequently, particles are reorganizing quite early in the.
We see reorganizations all the way down to the.
This is not crystallized stuff. This is called spurious stuff. Mm-hmm. It's got some. It does have some order, but it's not obvious. It's not strong order.
It's fascinating. You can see some of that order looking at this at the bottom of your.
Right. There could be some order, perhaps, but it's not intended as a unified crystal system.
So are you going to show us quickly this PDF from the other group?
Could I insert one comment about the figure you showed before? You don't have to bring it back up, but the observation that the degree of shortening E did not affect the distribution function significantly is consistent with a concept that we have in soil mechanics or sediment mechanics, that in a uniaxial consolidation state, the horizontal stress correlates with the vertical stress. Mm-hmm. And so one would expect that if you could normalize that by the mean stress, you would have the same kind of distribution. So your experiment seemed to be consistent with that.
Yeah, I think it's carried over to the Osmond thing.
Okay.
This is transmission coefficients you apply. If you notice in the silo, when people apply a load, then there's this uniform transmission of stresses to the cycle, which depends only on the proposal on the load.
This assumes non-adhesive grains.
It could also be adhesive. It's a large scale phenomenon. It's an experimental phenomenon. Because we don't unload it. Carry unloading it stuff.
So what these guys have, does everybody know this paper? Or maybe I can show everyone, but okay. So the basic experiment is a big cylindrical container of particles. And then what they have is, so here are all the particles. They put a wheel on top, and then they rotate the thing. Okay, and then they're looking at the bottom of this thing through a photoelastic sheet. So this actually, in some sense, it's the same scale as the 3D experiments I was showing you. So it's this size. And now what they see is that at the eighth year, in close in to the center, things don't slip. And then as you move out, they start to slip.
And the packing on the bottom, if I remember, is pretty crystalline.
I would certainly expect it would be highly crystalline because these are a lot of quantum scale for some columns versus the particles. So I would think it would probably pretty. And now, so what they see is, since these are really different.
I think the right hand side and pull this up to the
and just to close the right hand
side. Get rid of that right hand side, we see there's a high. And now do the plus. Now.
So now they're doing this for different depths, right? And now the trick is, so if you look at their fairly deep pile.
So they illuminate with some sheet.
They have this one. Okay, so then you look at their photoelastic sheet and you see, you see different illuminations, and then somehow they convert that into a force. Okay. And in ways that I don't totally understand. And then presumably there's no way for them to distinguish between whether it's a normal force or a shear force, and if you think it all, it's basically normal forces. Okay, now, so the peculiar thing is that when, let's see if I get this right.
The different colors are just different depths?
They're at different distances, radial distances from the center.
Oh, okay. Oh.
All right. So depending on whether you're in the sort of compressive region where everything is presumably just mushed down, or you're in a region where there's shear, they see a different distribution. Okay. And so then what they claim is that, I don't know if other people have seen an earlier paper about this group where basically they made a kind of thermodynamic argument that what you're looking at in the P1s is something akin to what you look at if you looked at G of R. Okay, so G of R is just some measure of, so you're looking at some average of E to the minus beta times the potential. So then the argument goes that this is just representative of the force bond that you have between the particles. Right? I remember seeing this paper back, and this is like 5 years ago. Okay. And so then the claim is that they can understand these as just different manifestations of the same probability distribution function, but in some sense just by scale and say with the appropriate value of the mean choice. And again, that's the means. Okay. All right, so S is the distance from the center of the shear of the system. Okay. And so close to the center is the blue. So this is like the squeezing down, which is what they claim is an equivalent to their what they see in static compressive experiments, right? So back in 10 years ago or something like that, when they first look at P of S, what this group did was they filled a container with spheres with a layer of carbon paper underneath, and they pushed down to the rock. And so then what they claim to see then in that regime, which is sort of more like just a compressive regime, is then they see this thing that is just an exponential distribution of forces. Okay. And then as they move out into the regime which is shearing, in the most extreme example is the low distribution. Okay. So in some sense, the thing I don't understand is it seems to me to be the reverse of what we see. Okay. So if you think of these as measuring the normal forces, then when we're in a regime which is characterized by strong shear, we see something which is basically exponential. And when we're in a regime which is more or less isotropic compression, we see something that's more gassy.
But they take the measurements sort of in situ while the thing is shearing. Like they don't let the thing come back to rest.
No, so the idea is that's right. So they take, I don't know, 10,000 frames over some period of time.
Aren't they measuring a plane perpendicular to the Earth?
Well, yes. But no, mine doesn't have a plane perpendicular. Mine is vector forces.
Correct, but their forces that would be analogous to yours would be those radially oriented. And here, if I'm correct, they're measuring from the base, right?
Well, I mean, one plane is, so they're looking at the right, so they're taking a cut.
So it's like this, it's spinning this way.
That's right.
And they're measuring this way.
Like,
they're measuring forces that are oriented vertically, though in your geometry you have forces that are varying around in a two-dimensional sense around the angle.
If you ask, there's the velocity,
right,
presumably
the directional shear, right,
tangential rather, the gradients, is presumably radial, right, and they're measuring in the third direction, normal to both of those, which is not something you have any information about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't exist.
And so it's not obvious
how to compare them.
So it seems that, I mean, in a way, this is a response to the normal. The normal load is what they're measuring, and the normal load is varying in response to the radiant.
Sure. Sure.
That's right. So you could say somehow that since this direction is not really involved with the motion, the scrambling of things through shear is sort of eliminating the frustration of this degree of freedom and moving really high forces,
but then you're shear in both directions.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not just shear, right? I mean, as you go regularly outward, you shear.
I like the shear as a function of height.
Sure.
Do you have any of that? Which is bigger, the shear as a function of height, or the shear as a function of height?
I have no idea. I don't say no either, because they can't. You don't look at bot. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't looked at this picture, but I'm confused about what they're doing here. Do they have like a turntable that they're pushing down from the top, or do they have something from the side?
It's a turntable, and they're pushing and it's a rather different geometry.
But Julie, something that you could easily. Well, I guess you do normally 2D, but you have some.
Oh, but you can be done in 3D.
Yeah,
so the question is how much of that disruption propagates in the normal direction? The frustration, as you say.
Yeah.
It's a neat concept that, in fact, it strengthens the system in the normal direction. In a sense, it doesn't have to, have to put words in it. I think the way you describe it, and I'll put it in my words and then you can see how fine tune this, but as the shearing is taking place, there's two-dimensional there's contacts that are occurring that are basically supporting the load in the lateral direction, and that is reducing the load in the vertical direction, or the stress in
the
vertical
direction. The fluctuation.
Yeah.
Fluctuations.
Okay. Well, and there's no one to mean, right? But I don't, at least, yeah, these are just facts. We do not know what that means.
But, how come it's...
So when you're sharing the load, that's, as you said, the means, and as well as the fluctuation.
One thing that we've made an effort to do in our models is to normalize by a constant mean force at different points within the experiment.
By the local mean.
Yeah, because the forces are varying through time as
sure.
you go.
Well, in space, right? Well, that's something which is.
Yeah, but it's say if we're going to do some kind of averaging, of course, that to me.
Well, I mean, these do represent the distribution over time. So, but hopefully, I mean, at any given ring, it's just a
time is running out as well.
Yes. Okay.
Who's got time?
Nothing that I show, nothing that I have really needs to be shown. But comment I'd like to make, though, is that because I like to think in stress space. The forces, this is very eye-opening for me to see how the forces have been studied before, but we actually sum the forces to determine the stress field
uh-huh.
in a domain.
Right.
And so, I was just going to quickly show how that is done, but it's not that difficult.
To compute the Cauchy stress.
Yeah, to compute the stress.
We've done some.
And then we've also done a little bit of work on the orientation distribution of the forces. The normal forces, regardless of whether you factor in the shear forces, because like you say, it's a very small component, the force distribution is very clearly correlated with the stress field, as one would expect. So the reason I was jumping in there to comment on the fact that the compression and the shear experiments that you show are just two points on a continuum of possibilities of stress.
Right, stress distributions. And that's absolutely true.
And there's going to be a very strong correlation with the force distribution. I think that's something that hasn't been quantified very well. We have data points, like, for a particular stress field, like you're showing here, but I love the concept that you posed yesterday, that in compression, when you do the orientation distribution, of course, everything lies on a common line, but as the stress becomes more and more not anisotropic, those two diverge. And what's the extreme? At what point do the force distributions, when you don't have adhesion, when you don't have bonding, at what point where you simply now, you have taken away all of the stress that's acting in the perpendicular direction of principal stress, then you wouldn't see any forces at all. So there, that whole gradient would be very interesting.
But you can't quite get there because it will massively fail.
Yeah.
By the time you get close to that.
Right.
I love to see what you do.
Or I can make better. But if it's just showing how you sum up the forces.
No, I have the animation to
the animations would be. I think the summing of forces to get local stresses and that balance is probably something people.
Yeah, that's
all people would see because we do that in MD.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
But I do have some animations I don't think I showed before. So yeah, that could
the
be.
Animations.
And some I have shown. So you can do that. Mm-hmm. But we used this force, this stress calculation, and then we calculated the average stress on a particle.
Yeah, it will.
Look, bring it up.
I think.
There's a dot at the front of it, that's what it doesn't like.
Oh, I see.
Could that be like your...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, that's
a period.
Right.
But I wonder if
No, just.
Well, once you're done.
Yeah, so let me just find the interesting. So this is taking that approach of calculating the average stress on the particles in the Sherman assemblage, and then plotting up, in this case, the mean stress on the particle, because there's mean and differential component. So if you plot the differential component, you plot the mean stress. So it's essentially.
That represents the difference in principal stresses.
No, in this case, it's the sum of principal stresses, or the average principal stresses, I should say. And then we color code those, and the color indicates that, so as the color becomes hotter, the mean stress increases, and we do recognize these very distinct force chains. So it's very similar to what you were shown with the photoelastic discs, when in this case we just have
color. What are the bars? Are they rotation?
And the bars represent the principal stress direction for a local region. And so in fact, that experience correlates quite well, of course, with the stress indications. And then just to give you a sense of geometry here, I have walls that are rough, and those are shearing in this direction. So right lateral shear strain. And this will evolve with time, and I'm just taking a couple of snapshots here. So I'm going to look at 160% shear strain. And this is the stress strain diagram starting at 100. So you're not seeing the initial stages. It's just starting at 100 going to 200. Then over here are actually the particle forces plotted from center to center. Just the normal force, because the shear force can be quite high and it results in a rotation and creates a lot of confusion in interpreting it. And then in the back, and so they scale the increase in width indicates an increase in the particle force. And then behind that is the gradient in the horizontal displacement, so over the last 2% shear strain. This is essentially an incremental shear structure, one could say. It's where a slip is occurring. And red indicates that there's a band on which slip is occurring. So we see this evolve over these 8% shear strain. And one of the interesting things to watch is how the colors in the particles over here change as we enter the shear. So we'll just go through a couple of these. You can see that the strain continues to be localized in this general area, but becomes a little more diffuse. And we now have quite a few red particles indicating strong force chains. And the next increment of strain, we're going to lose quite a few of those as we went from slip in this position to slip in this position. So this was accommodated by breakage of these force chains, and where the breakage was most intense or most rapid is when you get the localization forming. And we can follow that in a number of different ways, like this, or by looking at particle rotations in a given component.
Do you understand that all the chains seem to be more horizontal than 45 degrees? Do you understand why?
Well, they tend to span around 45 degrees. So this is something to.
Maybe I'm wrong, but to my eye, it seems like they're all sort of, you know, less than 45, more horizontal than 45.
There's this. Is it an aspect ratio issue?
Thinking about this, in some of these simulations I have turned off rolling, which would make it stronger. This is not one of those. So these particles are able to roll.
Okay.
But I do see this band like that, but then elsewhere we see bands that seem to be a little bit steeper. So my sense is when we average these up, they tend to fluctuate around 45 degrees. But that's just one example. This is a slightly different experiment, a higher velocity. And the increase in the velocity creates a difference in the stress strain diagram as well. Previously, let me just back up a second, so you can see very nice stick slip like responses where you have an elastic loading phase and then a precursory slip undergoes some local plastic deformation and then a sudden stress drop. And as you increase the sliding velocity of the walls, you get a more oscillating mode of deformation. That's something that follows, which we've also shown. But still, the same type of phenomenon occurs in the force chain development and dissipation.
Here's a probably low angle one.
When you have higher velocities, deformation tends to be more distributed throughout. These are, they're spheres, but they lie in a plane, fixed common plane, and there are no other spheres in our thing. But we're using Hessian contact law to calculate the forces at the contacts for spheres.
It's clear when you say high velocity. The question is what the scale velocity is. Now,
it's actually in millimeters per second.
Okay, but in terms of what we see at least in some of the glassy simulations, if you're going fast enough that stress can't equilibrate across the sample after some rearrangement has occurred, then you're more likely to see slip in many different locations like this, and any large steps in the force tend to get averaged out because you have different processes adding in coherently throughout the depth of the sample.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about what the effect of sound velocity or stress equilibration time is for systems?
We actually choose very small time steps with the intention that perturbations will have a chance to propagate across.
Well, the time step is irrelevant. That's just your integration time. The question is, what's your velocity?
Velocity relative to the sound velocity? It's very small.
But it's not, again, it's not the sound velocity of the particle, it's the sound velocity across the assembly.
So that's the sound velocity, the relevant velocity? She has this frictional contacts between the discs? That means the stress perhaps equilibrates much more slowly than in the molecular simulation.
For even in the molecular simulation, you see some very slow dynamics associated with rearrangements.
Well, I haven't calculated the sound velocity for this particular assemblage. But just to throw out some numbers, we're using values of density and stiffness that are analogous for quartz beads or sand. And for an assemblage with this density, the geologic system, even not only the geologic system, the velocity would be on the order of kilometers per second. And here I'm shifting this at a rate of millimeters per second. So I'm not too concerned about that contrast. Is that?
Well,
is this sort of what you're thinking?
You're saying you're at a level of consolidation such that all of the contacts are inelastic. The fact that you have these, it's an inhomogeneous media, and it can also have multiple sound modes. And there's a very fast acoustic mode, right, which may be the kilometer per second that you're talking about.
Compressional.
And that's the one that typically would remain undamped in the long wavelength limit. There also can be other modes. You've got some damping, so you can have diffusive propagation, stress equilibration, and all sorts of other much slower shear time scales.
Those are the things that are probably affecting this.
Right. Well, and so those are stress equilibration depends on all of those. And so it's the stress equilibration time would not necessarily be the one related to your kilometer.
Wouldn't you then expect if you were starting to move at slide speeds such that you were exceeding the wave propagation time, wouldn't you expect like a qualitative change in the kinds of behavior you'd see in the sample, like distributing stress relaxing sort of uniformly across an entire system, whereas here it seems like just a quantitative shift in how wide the region that's slipping at any given time is.
Well, you see multiple regions. So what you could say is there's a correlation length which is set by the propagation velocity and the shear rate, right? That gives me
But you're looking at this and saying regions as opposed to one thicker region? Is that?
Yeah.
Because it's periodic bending, so that's one.
Yeah, it's periodic and lateral.
One connected thing.
Could you show the movie?
That's a good point.
Look at the movie and see.
So, this, to back up on this one, or look at the image?
Yeah, let's just look at this one.
Okay.
It looks like a thick. You just think it's a thick region?
A thicker, yeah.
See, there's that way down there.
Happens down there, but.
Actually, I think these may be animated. These are,
See, look at that.
These are even higher velocity. And what's plotted here, and Bob has seen these. You can see the higher velocity of results, you can see the more distributed definition. What's plotted here are basically the gray bars that we saw on the right-hand side are now color-coded, but still increasing the thickness as a function of the inner particle force. And we're using exactly the same colors in this diagram. We have very small particles in this system, but now we have larger particles, it's a lot easier to see the force chains developing and fused. One thing to point out is that at the 0% strain, we have consolidated this package this way, so we have a principal direction of force change that's subvertical. But now you can look at this, this is 10% strain, so between 5 to 10% strain is what it takes to get to a relatively stable strength, and within that time period, you can see the equating information of these force changes and increase in magnitude because we're not changing the normal stress. So in order for the shear stress, the attitude is to increase the total.
But if you actually looked at the probability distribution of the force during that period.
Yeah, I haven't done that. That's what I'm keeping in this evolution stage, which is quite interesting. And also the jumps with the high to low.
So see, now you see a much more constant friction force, and I think there's basically a coherent, well, but I think as long as you are going slow enough, and that will depend upon how big your system is or how many particles you have, as long as you're going slow enough that the entire system is stress equilibrated, that you will get localization on one primary. But if you start going faster, then you know, at some point, each region just feels the average stress and does its own shearing and its own instability independent of all the others, and then you get this smoothing up. And in the molecular realm, there's some evidence that that happens. So.
So do you think of that as a physical phenomenon or a numerical artifact?
Well, I think the issue is that one wants to know what the... I think it's a real effect. It's set by a scale velocity, and the question is, what is the scale velocity? I think it's related to stress equilibration, which I think is much slower than the naive estimates that you would have from acoustic sound velocities. And I think it's interesting to know what that stress equilibration velocity is, whether it's a velocity, whether it's diffusive, you know, and in the amp system, it may be diffusive at large light scales.
So, I mean, how much is known about these slow relaxation modes in the electrical system?
Very little, as far as I know.
Okay. Yeah, so not something, because, I mean, we also see these, so the conduct is within the IRR. The simulations of a similar flavor, except that this system are this block right now. And there's very clearly a slow mode in the systems, but it's not clear how it recognizes it or what it relates to.
Right. So if you take a crystal, it's pretty clear that it's the sound velocity, right? When you take an ideal fluid, it's pretty clear. But in some sort of glassy, amorphous solid with a lot of low frequencies, it's not so obvious. We just see really slow stuff, and I think it's neat, but I don't know what But here, one in principle could try to superimpose stress on the system and watch its relaxation.
Bingo, that's what we're...
Take a simulation, take a state, and just impose some vertical stress increment on it and see how...
Yeah, or just, you know, make a small increase in the sliding velocity of the wall, or any number of things, and watch the...
But when you say watch, you want to know what's happening across the domain.
You want to watch it moving from one side to the other, yeah.
And in this case, we have anti-symmetric shear, so we're moving there for a while, same rate in opposite directions.
So you could just put a little dilational bump on one side, you could put a small increase on one or two walls and not the other. And,
right, yeah. It would be quite useful to do, I'm sure.
So basically, the bottom line is molecular people see it, but don't understand.
I don't know how many people have even seen it.
Look directly for stress relaxation. Now, I know there, we've looked for, we see slow relaxations at stresses below the yield stress. I mean, we look for inelastic, look at the time scale, holding its rising stress and holding its stresses below the yield stress.
And that's not like creep, right?
No, because
at zero temperature or
at very low temperatures.
Well, you also have, you know, just regular elasticity, since, as you were saying, the glass, there are all these low nodes lying around, and these low nodes participate in the elasticity too.
Right. So there was some evidence with Yorg that we were seeing times about two orders of magnitude lower than expected for stress equilibration without actual rearrangements. But
that would also, those kinds of times would also show up in just the sound speed too, I would think.
Well,
I mean, the kinds that I was just talking about, just having low line modes in the spectrum of line modes, that piece should
show up. Well, but the point is that you might then have multiple sound, I mean, the sound, there's the sound speed, and then there's other types of modes. There's a lot of, like if you take a fluid-filled rock, there are many different sound speeds that are measured. You know, there's acoustic propagation through the rock, there's acoustic propagation through the fluid, then you can get mixed modes that can be much slower due to the torque velocity of the pore space. So, it is related somehow to these low frequency modes, but the question is, are there any of those low frequency modes with long wave as well?
So let me pose a slightly different question, which may connect you to modes that you call aeronautics. How sensitive is the observation of, say, the slow time line to boundary conditions that you apply, so it's line versus one reason why I ask that is that this group may not know about the work by Amelia Kudikan. So these are ground avalanche flows with a free surface in the vertical direction. And basically, you can take lots of different measures. So he's been studying the system for a lot of years. And you can take almost any measure he wants and claims that then you can express it simply in terms of a shear rate times a particle diameter scale by the acoustic speed. It was a unique time scale system set by the acoustic speed of the scales. Right. So particle diameter divided by the acoustic speed.
Where the acoustic speed would be the
square root of p or whatever.
This is the generation of the component.
So lots of different things that I can point you to.
This is an important discussion. That's no question.
Shall we continue?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.